Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Alaska World Affairs Council. My name is Lisa Falsco. I'm the Executive Director. And if you could please take a moment to turn off your cell phones, this program will be recorded for KSKA. Thank you so much to William Toyer for doing the recording today for future broadcast and download on the KSKA website. We are delighted to offer a couple of books again today. The one is a free report of the Stinson Group, which we'll be talking about later in our program, and also our program next week with Victor Komras, his book Flawed Diplomacy. If you want to get a head start on the book, we have a few more that are available for purchase. This is our last reminder to apply for your PFD and to please consider making a donation to the Alaska World Affairs Council through the Pick, Click, Give program. Already this year, lots of fellow Alaskans have made the choice to donate part of their PFD to a worthy nonprofit, so consider the World Affairs Council and make sure you get your applications in. We are a membership organization. If you aren't a member, please stop by the front desk on your way out and become a membership of the World Affairs Council to help support our programs. And if you would like to become more involved in steering an organization that is dedicated to stimulating interest in world affairs, we are currently accepting application for the World Affairs Council Board of Directors. So come and join a dynamic group of individuals. Applications are due at the end of this month. At this time, I'd like to recognize any students present. We'd like to thank BP for sponsoring student lunches. We see you in the back. Thank you. Thanks for coming. And we'd also like to thank Nana Pacific, who is currently sponsoring free memberships for all students to the World Affairs Council. So if you currently do not have a student membership, you can stop by their front desk and get a free Alaska World Affairs Council membership thanks to Nana Pacific. Today's program, as you all have noticed, is not on our normal Friday. Thanks to Kari Gardy, our program coordinator, she recognized and applied for a grant from the Stimson Center to bring Mr. Bleckman to Alaska to speak about a fascinating report published by the U.S. Institute of Peace. The World Affairs Council would like to warmly thank the Stimson Center and the Alaska World Affairs Councils of America for sponsoring our program today and for bringing our speaker and providing the materials. And now I'd like to introduce our head table. I am joined today by one of our newest board members who will be introducing our speaker, as well as, I won't say one of our oldest board members, Chuck Becker, to my far left, who is a board member emeritus and has been a big contributor and helped the World Affairs Council for quite a while, and Oksana Lazareva, if you'd like to come to the podium and introduce our speaker today.
It is really my pleasure today to introduce our speaker. I'm sorry I have an accent, so it's going to be a little harder for you to understand what I'm saying. Anyways, Dr. Barry Blichman, he is the co-founder of the Stimson Center, distinguished fellow focused on nuclear disarmament. He is here today to speak to us on the results from Iran study group sponsored by the Stimson Center and United States Institute of Peace. The final report called Engagement, Coercion, and Iran's Nuclear Challenge is available today at the front desk. Blichman has nearly 50 years of distinguished service in national security in both public and private sectors. He is an expert on political and military policies, military strategy, and defense budget and industries. Blichman had worked in the Department of State and Defense at the Office of Management and Budget. Among other boards and commissions, Blichman served on the commission to assess the ballistic missile threat to the United States, the Defense Policy Board, the Mayor's Bioterrorism Preparedness and Response Program Advisory Committee in the District of Columbia, and also the Department of State Advisory Committee on Transformational Diplomacy. Bleachman founded DFI International Incorporation, a research consultancy, in 1984 and served as its CEO till 2007. Dr. Bleachman holds a PhD in international relations from Georgetown University, has taught at several universities, and has written extensively on national security issues. His most recent publications are Elements of Nuclear Disarmament 30 and National Perspectives on Nuclear Disarmament. He is here today. Let's welcome him. Let's welcome Dr. Bleachman to our podium.
As you get older, the introductions get longer. I remember speaking for the first time at the National War College, and I was introduced as the youngest person ever to speak at the National War College, and I must say I much preferred that introduction than this one. But I have I moved to Washington in 64 right out of getting my master's degree, and thought I'd stay a couple years and somehow haven't managed to escape. I'm one of those people that move in and out of government, serving, as was said, both in the Pentagon and at the State Department and at the Office of the Budget at different times, and at a variety of nonprofit think tanks. This past summer, if you'll recall, there's been so many crises over this year that last summer's crisis was the thought many people had that Iran was about to acquire nuclear weapons. The Israelis particularly were very concerned about this and had mounted a very strong campaign to get the United States to conduct military strikes to take out Iran's nuclear facilities. And we started this study together with the U.S. Institute for Peace, which is an institution funded by the Congress, to look at the various options available to the United States at the time. We had about 40 people on the study group. 20 of them were Iranian experts on Iran's internal politics, many of them former Iranian expatriates who had been forced to leave the country, and about half were former U.S. diplomats and military officials and people like myself who have studied these kinds of issues for many years. So what I'd like to do is summarize the report's findings and then open it up to questions, and we can talk about other issues in the Middle East, if you'd like, or other nuclear issues, as well as Iran, which for now, at least, is on the back burner. And one reason it's on the back burner, and a key finding of our study, is that there are some years before Iran could acquire a nuclear weapon. The Israelis themselves have changed their position. Back in December, the retiring head of their Mossad, their intelligence organization, as well as the deputy prime minister, both said that there were 3 years at least before Iran could have a weapon, and that is the same assessment made by the U.S. government. General Clapper, in fact, who's the director of national intelligence, testified just last week that the judgment of the U.S. community, intelligence community, was that Iran did not have a weapons program at the current time. We know it had one up till 93 at least, up till 2003 at least, but it appears that they're not working on the weapon components. What they are doing is enriching uranium. Uranium has the isotope of uranium, which is used to make nuclear weapons, which can explode, has to be a certain percentage of any mass of material for the weapon to work. It has to be over 90% of the material. in uranium that occurs naturally, that's mined from the ground, it's less than 1%. To be used in power reactors to make electricity, it has to be enriched to 3 to 4%. And to be used in medical reactors to make isotopes for treating cancer patients, for example, it has to be enriched to 20%. What the Iranians are doing is enriching uranium to 3 to 4%, the level required for power reactors. And they've taken a small amount of that and enriched it further to 20%. And that's important because it reduces, the higher the enrichment, the lesser time required to enrich it to the level where it could be used in bombs. So the United States and the European countries and most of the world community is very interested in stopping Iran's uranium enrichment, which they're entitled to. There's no prohibition against doing it, as long as the facility is monitored and supervised by the International Atomic Energy Agency, which, in fact, their facility is. Just having the enriched uranium isn't enough to give you a bomb. You have to machine it then, which is difficult to do because it's radioactive, so you need very specialized equipment. Machine it into a shape which can be used in a bomb. It can be in the form of a cylinder with a hollowed out center, and then in what's called a gun device, a slug of enriched uranium is fired into the cylinder, and that creates the critical mass for an explosion. Or it could be made into two half spheroids, which are brought together, and then explosives wired around it and compressed, and that creates the nuclear explosion. But in any event, you have to machine the enriched uranium, which is very difficult, and it's not clear from public information whether or not they have that capability. You also need other specialized components to make a nuclear weapon, and the judgment, at least, of the intelligence community and now of the Israelis, who have the most at stake here, is that they do not have such capabilities and won't have them for 3 to 5 years, at least. The reason they don't have it, or one reason, is the economic sanctions which have been put on Iran. There have been six UN resolutions putting increasingly strict sanctions on the kind of trade countries or companies can engage with in Iran, trying to restrict their ability to acquire the specialized equipment and to acquire normal armaments as well. And they've been getting tighter and tighter, and followed by almost all countries in the world. There's a black market, of course, but that makes it more difficult. Even the Russians, which have been reluctant to put sanctions on Iran, are now strongly supporting the UN sanctions. In fact, the Russians, who were about to sell Iran an advanced surface-to-air missile, defensive missile, which would make it harder for us to attack their facilities. They had a deal, they had a check for $800 million, which they had to return to Iran following passage of the UN sanctions in June of this past year. So the sanctions are working, and it's making it difficult, the UN sanctions making it difficult or more difficult for them to acquire the specialized materials and equipment they need to make a bomb. In addition to the UN sanctions, the US, the European Union, Japan, Korea, and a bunch of other countries have put on financial sanctions, making it illegal to invest in Iran, or to at least to invest in companies which are associated with the Revolutionary Guard and other Iranian government institutions. And this is hurting their economy a great deal because if a bank, for example, is caught financing a deal in Iran with one of these prohibited institutions, it's prohibited from doing deals in the United States or in the European Union. So if you are a Turkish bank, for example, and you have the choice of a little deal in Iran or access to the advanced economies, all the advanced economies in the world, which do you choose? So all investment has ended in Iranian oil and natural gas, which is, you know, essentially their whole economy. So their economy is hurting, and their GNP is falling, their inflation is going up, they have huge problems, domestic problems with unemployment, drug use, and so forth. And this is feeding into, feeding into a very conflictive internal political situation. Now, we all know about the Green Movement, the Popular Democracy Movement, which was very prominent after the rigged election in 2009, but that's essentially been squelched. But within the ruling elites, there is a very vicious factional political conflict going on. And essentially, you have the hardliners, or the hardest liners, they're all conservatives, represented by Ahmadinejad, the president who rigged the elections. And they are in conflict with the traditional elites, the religious leadership, the people in the parliament, the judiciary, and they're trying to supplant them and gain the spoils that comes with being part of what's a corrupt, elite-run government. So there's this internal conflict going on. The traditional elites, who are being threatened by Ahmadinejad and his colleagues, his allies in the Republican Guards, are using the nuclear issue against him. They're saying, look, he's pursuing this nuclear issue in such a blatant way and antagonizing the rest of the world to such an extent that it's isolating us, that it's harming our economy, and it's isolating us from most of the world. We have good friends like Venezuela, Chavez and Venezuela, Castro and a few others, but where it counts, countries with resources, we're increasingly isolated. China continues to do some business with Iran, but not in violation of the UN sanctions, but they don't follow the financial sanctions. So this conflict is going on. And so the question is how to swing the balance in Tehran so that those who would be willing to negotiate a deal that can assure the West that they could not build a nuclear weapon in a short period of time can gain the upper hand and we can start having serious negotiations. There have been a couple of rounds of negotiations. Well, the last one was in Istanbul in December, and it went absolutely nothing. It was two sides talking at each other, not trying to reach an agreement. So this group looked at the options available to the United States. The most prominent one at the time we were meeting last summer was the military option. There was a lot of agitation from parts of the Congress and from the Israelis, as I said, that the U.S. should conduct a military strike and destroy their enrichment facilities, their nuclear laboratories, and other things. To my surprise, the group that looked at that, which included quite a number of former military and diplomats, were unanimously opposed to the military option. They said this is not a case like when the Israelis bombed the reactor in Iraq back in the 1980s, where you can get the reactor and that's that. Iran is a much larger, stronger country. If the United States or any other power carried out a strike at the nuclear facilities. It would carry out a very large strike attempting to, one, destroy the air defenses, as we're doing in Libya, and two, to destroy the country's conventional forces, because it would be expected that Iran would retaliate for any airstrike with any means at its disposal. And they have quite considerable means. And they could retaliate against facilities along the Persian Gulf, oil facilities, the big transshipment points where the tankers load, for example, are very lucrative targets. They could retaliate with their terrorist allies, Hamas and Hezbollah, which are along Israel's borders, so retaliate against Israel. They could strike U.S. military facilities. They could try to kill Americans anywhere in the world through their terrorist organizations. They've certainly been willing to do that in the past. Moreover, and in a sense, more importantly, in terms of the goal here, which is to stop the nuclear program, the belief of the group is that more than anything, this would unite Iran. After all, the regime in Iran was formed in opposition to the United States. And this would reinforce the message of some 30, almost 40 years ago, that the United States, the great Satan, as they like to call us, is the enemy and is intent on destroying the Persian state, the Persian culture. So this would unite Iran, redouble their efforts to build a weapon, and it would buy time, but it wouldn't solve the problem. In fact, they said we should not threaten the use of force. We're fond, Secretary Clinton, for example, always says, you know, remember, all the options are on the table, which people understand to mean, we might use military force at some point. That kind of threat only feeds the hardliners. They say, see, America's getting ready to strike us. We need to build these nuclear weapons to protect ourselves. Whereas an engagement policy strengthens the hands of the softliners, where they say, see, there is a possibility to reach an agreement with these countries that can serve both sides' interests. So the group rejected the military option, and it recommended essentially three things. One, that we continue the sanctions, and also there are covert operations being staged against the nuclear facilities. You may have read about the computer virus, which was introduced last summer or fall, which destroyed apparently a large number of the centrifuges, which is what's used to enrich uranium. There's been doctored materials. You know, one thing about being forced into the black market to acquire materials is you really don't know who you're dealing with. And some smart intelligence agencies were able to send doctored materials into Iran, which they thought were good, and caused them all kinds of difficulties in some aspects of their program. And there have also been assassinations carried out of some of their nuclear scientists. It's not clear who's doing that, possibly the Israelis, possibly. There's another terrorist organization operating against Iran, based largely in Iraq. So the group thought we should continue the pressure on Iran through sanctions and through these covert operations to the degree they're possible. But in addition, the group felt that we should make a more serious effort to engage Iran diplomatically. And that meant, and President Obama has, you know, offered to talk with them when he first took office, and he made a speech in Cairo, which was rejected, and he sent them a letter, which was rejected. But in the conclusion of the study group, our efforts at engagement have not gone far enough. We haven't offered them something comparable to what we're asking them to give up. we're asking them to give up their enrichment, which they say is for peaceful purposes, for power reactors. And in exchange, we're saying, okay, you do that, and then we'll lift the sanctions. Well, what's in that for them? It's, you know, removing the punishment. There's nothing positive in there. So in the group's view, to reach an agreement, it's necessary, one, to give them the right, like any other country, to enrich uranium to the level required for power reactors, the low level, so long as they do not, given their history of their program, its secretive history, so long as they agree to certain conditions, which include continuing monitoring by the International Atomic Energy Agency, an agreement not to store more than a small amount of this material in country, so they couldn't quickly start enriching it to higher levels, to bomb levels, and to implement something called the Additional Protocol. The every country with a nuclear facility who's a party to the Non-Proliferation Treaty has an agreement called the Safeguards Agreement with the International Atomic Energy Agency. And this, under this agreement, they declare their nuclear facilities, we have this lab, we have this research reactor, we have these power reactors, and the agency inspects them periodically. It keeps track of the amount of nuclear material going in and coming out. It has cameras and tamper-proof seals on the facility so the materials can't be taken away for a secret weapons program and so forth. However, those agreements, the safeguards agreements, are restricted to declared facilities, the facilities the country says it has. Now, Iran has had secret facilities in the past, and to deal with that, there's something called the Additional Protocol, which gives the Atomic Energy Agency the right to inspect any facility in the country which it suspects of having a nuclear activity. So if there were a report that they had a secret enrichment facility somewhere else, the inspectors could demand to go there within a very short period of time and take a look and bring their radiation detectors and so forth. So that would be part of the deal. In exchange for that, we believe the U.S. and its allies, and which is virtually the entire world, is allied on this issue, should be willing to not only lift the sanctions, but to permit Iran to modernize and to help Iran modernize its oil and natural gas production. Their oil fields are old, they have old technology, production is inefficient and declining, and they need new technology. There's no Western companies operating in Iran now. They've all pulled out, even Lukoil, the Russian oil company, which was a big investor in Iran for some time. So they have no access to the technology they need to extract oil more efficiently, and they have huge natural gas reserves which could be exploited and either piped out of the region or turned into liquefied natural gas and moved out in tankers. It would certainly help the world energy situation, but it would also help Iran. It's about its only source. That and pistachio nuts is about all they have for exports. The group also thought that separately, these talks are done, and it's in a group called the P5 plus one. It's the permanent members of the UN Security Council, US, UK, France, Russia, and China, plus Germany representing the European Union. The P5 plus one is the group that negotiates the nuclear issue. In addition to that, our study group thought that the US should engage in bilateral negotiations with Iran on a variety of issues in which we have a common interest. One is Afghanistan. Iran was very helpful, actually, in Afghanistan in 2001 and 2 and 3 when we first went in there, because they have good ties with the ethnic groups up in the northern part of Afghanistan. Another is the drug trade, for example, where they have a huge drug problem. It comes out of Afghanistan through Iran. A lot of it stays there, but then it goes through Iran into Russia sometimes or into Western Europe. So there could be cooperation in trying to stem the drug trade. And there are other issues of mutual interest that we could discuss with them separately as way of showing the benefits of reaching this agreement on the nuclear issue. And finally, I don't know if you know, but U.S. diplomats are now prohibited from interacting with Iranian diplomats in third countries or in international organizations. So, like when our ambassador in Paris gets instructions to transmit a certain message to other ambassadors there, he doesn't talk to the Iranian ambassador. Or our ambassador to UNESCO or UN agency or whatever doesn't engage with his Iranian counterpart. We thought normalizing this relationship would be a good way of showing them the benefits of engagement. Now, there's no guarantee that this option could work. We could strengthen our willingness, what we're putting on the table from today until tomorrow, and the hardliners could still, keep control in Tehran and not be willing to reach agreement. We refer to it as the least bad option, because there's no really good options. So to prepare for the situation 5 years from now or whenever it might happen, that they do acquire a weapons capability if this policy failed, the last thing we recommend is that we cooperate more with the Arab states along the Gulf and with Israel to build up their defensive capabilities, conventional defensive capabilities. And there's two reasons for this. One is so that they don't feel compelled to acquire nuclear weapons in response to Iranian nuclear weapons. I mean, Israel already has them, but so that the Arab nations don't. And secondly, no one expects that Iran would use its nuclear weapons when it acquires them, except perhaps as a threat, but rather that having nuclear weapons would make them more aggressive in promoting their objectives along the Gulf. They have, as you know, there's a split among the Sunni Muslims and the Shia Muslims. Iran is Shia. There are Shia populations in other countries like Bahrain, in fact, which has a Shia majority. And the Iranians have been known to be subversive to the Bahraini government in support of the Shia. So if they had nuclear weapons, the thought is they'd be more aggressive. They might encourage their terrorist organizations, Hezbollah, for example, to be more aggressive against Israel. So the thought was that we should strengthen these countries' conventional defensive capabilities in preparation for the time, should it happen, that Iran does acquire nuclear weapons. So there's a lot more nuance than that in the report, but I've probably talked long enough, and I'm sure there are many questions or comments or people who want to hurl bricks at me. Go ahead.
What was the nature of Iran's relationship with Gaddafi in Libya?
They didn't have much of one that I know of. Gaddafi had very close relationship with the North Koreans and the Pakistanis, from whom he acquired components of nuclear capability that he was building and missile capabilities. But I don't know of any with Iran, actually. He was really kind of isolated. generally in the world.
As you mentioned, Israel does have nuclear weapons, some 200 at least is what's the number that's generally accepted. If the goal is a nuclear-free Middle East, and you've got Israel who's not a signatory to the NPT, they don't allow inspections, they've been involved in nuclear proliferation in places like apartheid-era South Africa, why is there no pressure on Israel, who is one of the more belligerent countries in the area, continually attacking Gaza, for example?
Well, I personally believe that there should be more pressure on Israel to move toward relinquishing its nuclear weapons, but they will not do that. Their nuclear weapons have not protected them. They had nuclear weapons in 1973, and Egypt and Syria attacked Israel, and as you might recall, in 1991, when we fought the first Gulf War, when we threw Iraq out of Kuwait, Saddam Hussein still fired missiles at Israel and hit Tel Aviv and other cities. So their weapons haven't protected them, but they believe that they're essential to their security. Now, the one bright side is there was the non-proliferation treaty is reviewed every 5 years, and at this last review, it was agreed that there would be a conference on making the Middle East free of nuclear weapons, and Israel was mentioned specifically. The conference is to be held in 2012, and a special emissary is being named who will prepare for that meeting and so forth. They won't get rid of their weapons, but at least it's a start of a dialogue. And the U.S. agreed to that conference and said it will participate and has said privately that we will put pressure on the Israelis to participate in the conference. So at least it's a start. But the real answer, of course, is domestic U.S. politics, which is why not more pressure is put on them. Why is that? Well, Israel has been a good ally of the United States in the Middle East throughout the Cold War, when the Soviet Union was very active in Syria and Yemen and Egypt, and we were quite concerned about Soviet Union getting control of the oil resources of the region. Israel was a good ally of ours. Israel is a democracy, one of the very few so far. Maybe there'll be some more in coming years in the Middle East, and shares many of our values. And the American Jewish population is very active in politics and has an influential lobby, just as the American Indian population has, for example. Yes, sir. North Korea is a tougher problem in many ways, because North Korea is a state that lives in isolation, and it doesn't have the aspirations of Iran. Iran is a great culture. Well, the Persian culture has a long, distinguished history, and it has a sense of itself as a world power. North Korea is essentially a mafia family, you know, protecting its assets. The only way to get North Korea is through China, the one country that provides North Korea with the resources it needs is China. It used to have the Soviet Union, but that ended when the Soviet Union ended. So it'll only happen when China leans heavily enough on the North Korean leadership or causes some sort of internal change through the military, probably, to get North Korea to give up its weapons. So far, the Chinese calculation has been that they'd rather have a nuclear-armed North Korea and stability on their border than the kind of chaos that might occur if the regime was overthrown. They're very worried about streams of North Korean refugees coming across the river there and so forth. The U.S. has, you know, we talk to the Chinese often, and we did, China did, if you recall, this past winter, the North Koreans staged a couple of provocations against South Korean forces. They shelled an island and they sank a South Korean ship. And we talked to the Chinese, and the Chinese did lean on them, and they behaved in a much more peaceful way since then. But the Chinese have not been willing to go so far as that. So that's the other big problem. But they also, North Korea doesn't have the resources that Iran has. So they have this handful of weapons. Their tests, the first test was definitely a failure. The second test may or may not have failed. It's not clear, or succeeded, it's not clear. So it seems to be, it's less of a threat than Iran would be. Because of the missile capability, right? They haven't tested them. I sat on the Rumsfeld Commission, I think was mentioned, which looked at the missile threat from these various countries. And the North Koreans tested their Taepodong 2 the week after our report came out. It made us look like geniuses. I always accused Rumsfeld of paying them to do that. but they haven't made much progress since then. So far, it seems all right. And putting a weapon, it's one thing to build a nuclear weapon, you know, a kind of primitive one, the kind we dropped on Japan. It's quite another thing to make one small enough that it can go on a missile nose cone and be carried thousands of miles. It has to be so precisely built, and the warhead has to be a different kind of design than those that are known publicly. So it's a tough problem for a country like that. Yes.
I was in your discussion, you talked about various options being on the table and some options using force that were already in play. I wonder if you could say something about the legal foundation for these kind of actions. Are they all extra legal? Are these proposals all extra legal? Or is there something within the Non-Proliferation Treaty that allows the use of violence against persons or property?
The treaty specifies that the International Atomic Energy Agency should bring violations that it discovers to the UN Security Council. And that's been the basis for these various sanctions that have been put on Iran. So at some point, if Iran seemed to be getting closer to a weapon, it would be possible, conceivable, let's say, for the UN Security Council to authorize collective use of force against Iran. The people who were advocating it last summer didn't have anything like that in mind, and currently it would not be possible because probably China or possibly Russia might veto such a resolution. That would be the legal basis if the government chose to go that route. When we didn't in Iraq, we saw the consequences of that. So.
Thank you for your talk today. You had mentioned that cyber war, in other words, the computer virus, material sabotage, and assassination, was also used against Iran. In terms of the computer virus that was used, the Stuxnet, as it was sometimes called, could you talk a little bit about the potential danger for this kind of technology and covert war rebounding on the industrial nations?
Yeah, I don't know very much about cyber warfare, and I'm not sure anyone outside of government does, but apparently, according to long articles in the New York Times, the U.S. and the Israelis and the British built a replica of the enrichment facility in Iran. It's at Natanz, and this is the one we're concerned about. And they built a replica of it, and based on information derived from these IAEA inspections and defectors. There have been a number of Iranian nuclear scientists who have defected from the program. And then over a long period of time, were able to design this worm, as they call it, to which upset the controls, these centrifuges, there are thousands of them, organized in cascades, and they whirl at huge speed, and the heavier isotopes move out of the material into the bottom. So this the control system is vital to it. And this worm disrupted the control system, and apparently something like half of the centrifuges were whirled off and broken. You know, certainly there's potential for other countries to do that. Many countries have advanced computer technologies and could design things intended to disrupt electrical networks or whatever. And it's a question of the government working in partnership with the industries to put up the kinds of defenses that are necessary. And I know that the Department of Homeland Security has put much more emphasis on this over the past several years, and they're the interface with the industry. So I don't know how well protected we are or not, but it's obviously a problem which could be used against us just as we apparently used it against them. Well, thank you very much. It's, I'm sorry, is there another? No?
I'd like to thank our guest speaker today, Dr. Barry Bleckman, and his book is available. There's a few copies at the front, so if you are lucky enough to receive one, you can pick that up on your way out. Like I said, our next program will be on Friday, not this Friday, but the following, upstairs back in the chart room with Victor Kromros, who will be speaking on flawed diplomacy. And to entice our speaker to come back, he is here, actually, coming through from visiting his daughter up in Fairbanks, so we were very fortunate to have him join us on a Wednesday, and we have a book for you of Alaska, some of the sites maybe you've missed, and hopefully you'll come back.
Thank you.
Thank you. We're also taking Mr. Bleckman to the University of Alaska Anchorage this afternoon to speak with some students, so thank you very much for stopping there as well. If you are coming, not this Friday, but the following Friday, please RSVP and look at our website for additional programs. Thank you.